Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dory Smith.
A properly resourced counterinsurgency probably means more forces. And without question, more time and more commitment to the protection of the Afghan people and to the development of good governance.
The Iraqi journalist who threw his shoes at former President George W. Bush spoke out Tuesday after his release from prison.
Six Italian soldiers were killed in a bomb attack today in Kabul, Afghanistan. The attack also killed 10 Afghan civilians. NPR's Sylvia Poggioli.
It was a weekend of deadly bombings in Iraq in a campaign claimed by al-Qaeda. More than 100 people died in the series of suicide attacks. The worst occurred in a town just south of Baghdad.
And I interviewed several different people that told me the same story. And then I interviewed several different people that told me of actually going out physically and faking a patrol by, like, going to a field and parking their Humvees.
We often, as often as we could, faked patrols, which was certainly a lot easier since there was no GPS back then.
U.S. military veteran Fred Lewis joins us with some reactions to comments made by journalist Dar Jamail about what U.S. soldiers are going through in Iraq and Afghanistan, how stop-loss policies are affecting them, and what soldiers who refuse to fight in these wars are going through. Fred Lewis is a Vietnam veteran, a vet for peace, from Central Connecticut. First, we're going to hear from some organizers of Dar Jamail's Connecticut tour who join us to talk about the importance of having this independent journalist here and to discuss the upcoming peace march in Boston October 17th and new energy within the American peace movement that is mobilizing to bring U.S. forces home from Iraq and Afghanistan. We hear from Eastern Connecticut State University Professor Helma DeVries, Connecticut peace activist and organizer Chris Hutchinson, a teacher, and Eastern Connecticut peace activist and organizer Miriam Kurland, who is also a media activist and a key person at the Wrench in the Works Collective in Willimantic, Connecticut. Dar Jamail's visit to Connecticut marks the UN's International Day of Peace, and organizations like Promoting Enduring Peace, as well as Connecticut United for Peace, Students Against the War, Iraq Veterans Against the War, Veterans for Peace, and other groups will be holding events at the very same time thousands of other groups are doing the same thing all over the world. There are six educational and organizing events in Connecticut over the 19th, 20th, and 21st, featuring Dar Jamail. He will speak about what is really going on in Iraq and Afghanistan today, the impact of independent journalists, and how more than 6 years of war has impacted U.S. soldiers who have been deployed and redeployed, regardless of their condition of health or their stated willingness to go. Professor Helma DeVries is in the Political Science Department at Eastern Connecticut State University, ECSU. She says she coordinated her event with Dar Jamail in order to help students gain the insights of a reporter who was on the ground in Iraq during 9 months, someone who ventured out well beyond the infamous Green Zone, where government personnel and most international journalists stayed put. Dar Jamail's book on the subject is Beyond the Green Zone, Dispatches from an Unembedded Journalist in Occupied Iraq, his second book, The Will to Resist, Soldiers Who Refuse to Fight in Iraq and Afghanistan. On September 16th, Professor DeVries held a film showing of Dar Jamail's Eyewitness in Iraq, an unembedded report. Some of the students at Eastern Connecticut State were in elementary school when 9/11 happened, and many have never seen a truly unembedded report from Iraq before.
This is Weekday. I'm Steve Scheer. Good morning. Freelance journalist Dar Jamail returned from Iraq earlier this month. Over 8 months he spent time there in different parts of the country, including Fallujah and Baghdad. Decided to report from Iraq to tell the stories he felt weren't being told by the U.S. media.
I went to Iraq because of what I have thought all along is a great disparity in the media as far as what most mainstream media outlets in the U.S. are reporting about the situation as compared to alternative media and foreign media.
Well, actually, it's interesting because if you look at the politics of the media and the research on that, you see that most of the media, mainstream media, the dominant sources that they are relying on are government sources. And if you look also at the way that they're framing news stories, they're very heavily reliant on the way that the government provides cues to them about how they should frame stories. And they very often adopt those frames. And you don't see a lot of competing frames, a lot of different sources being used to suggest different perspectives on issues. And so what I think is so important, especially about Dar Jamil's work, is that he has really gone to, in people's own words, actually report their stories and he doesn't alter those words. He really very often uses quotes directly from his sources, and he really talks to ordinary Iraqis about how their lives have been affected. He goes to hospitals. He talks about people's access to water, food, medical care, security. He talks to ordinary soldiers, even embedded journalists who do sometimes talk to soldiers. They very often talk to the government-approved soldiers who've been pre-screened for them to talk to. He actually talks to a whole range of people, and he quotes them directly, and he doesn't try to alter their words, but presents their own stories as much as possible, giving credit to what their own viewpoints are. And I think that's so important, especially because you don't see that variety in the media coverage. Now, admittedly, after the really poor media coverage leading up to the Iraq War, and even shortly thereafter, there has been more variety in the news reporting. But still, if you look at the research on this, most of the coverage really lacks this look to alternate sources outside of the government or government-approved sources. So I think that's very important for people to hear different perspectives that you don't hear in the mainstream media, and that's why it's so important for us to have him speak in different venues.
You know, these are difficult times for students, I know. How do they keep their hopes up? I mean, in a topic like this, do you think that they have to struggle to do that? Or is this the kind of subject they really need to learn about if they are going to stay focused on the positive and what can be done?
I think that something that's really important to realize is that Dar Jamil, with his life and what he's done with his work, his life commitment to his work, I think it's very inspirational for students. I see many students actually who are really coming into university already engaged in grassroots activism and wanting to make a difference in the world. And I think seeing how he's done that, you know, having gone from working on Mount Denali and listening to the coverage and saying, wait, you know, this is not good media coverage. I want to go and change this, and then doing something about it. I think that's very inspirational. A lot of our students I see are not so concerned about necessarily making the biggest bucks, but actually making a difference for the world that they leave behind. And I think hearing about other people that have done that kind of thing is very inspirational. And I see the transformative power in that.
Professor Helma DeVries at Eastern Connecticut State University, ECSU, the political science department there. And you can find all of the information about Dar Jamil's talks in Connecticut at willtoresistwar.blogspot.com. Let's turn now to another teacher at the elementary school level in Connecticut, Chris Hutchinson. Chris is going to be joining us to talk about another event on September 21st, this one at 6 p.m. at Central Connecticut State University. Dar Jamil is going to speak about how independent journalism changed Iraq and Afghan war coverage, and also about freedom of the press and freedom of speech on campuses in addition to internationally. Chris Hutchinson, why don't you tell us why it's important that when Dar speaks in Marcus White Living Room, Marcus White Hall at CCSU in New Britain, Connecticut at 6 p.m. on the 21st. He also mentions freedom of speech.
Well, it's going to be focusing around a free speech fight that's going on. The opinion editor for CCSU's The Recorder was fired for her political views. She was a member of a group called Youth for Socialist Action. She was writing articles about political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal and the wars in Iraq, and they pushed her out, saying that she was not working up to her abilities and these sort of things, and which is all untrue. And they've launched a huge free speech campaign. All different organizations on campus have been supporting her in that, and Darjamel, when he comes to CCSU, will be talking about, you know, these sort of things like ethics in the media and, you know, free speech on our campuses and in our campus publications.
It sounds like a fight for democracy and falls right in line with your other work for peace and justice, Chris Hutchinson. Why don't you talk with us about that work that you do and also about some of the planning going on around stopping the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and bringing U.S. forces home from those parts of the world?
Democracy, you know, is not something that happens once every 4 years in a voting booth. You know, it should be a consistent theme throughout our lives. And one way that people take that first step to, instead of sitting on the sidelines and watching history develop and actually participating in the making of history, is to join the mass movement, the mobilizations to end these wars. And when they do that for the first time, I know my first experience marching with thousands of people behind me that had similar ideas, you know, was very empowering. And I felt like I could actually affect change. And I think that is where change will come from, is when people are organized and they're putting enough pressure on the government that they see that there is another source of power in the country, and it's not all coming from the people who make all the decisions, the corporate elite and the government themselves, and the people actually have a tremendous amount of power.
Chris Hutchinson, I know, in addition to working on Darjamel's visit to Central Connecticut State University and other parts of the state of Connecticut, you're also working on organizational efforts, getting people out to a march and rally on Saturday, October 17th at 1 p.m., Copley Square, Boston, Massachusetts. And the flyer that you've given me here says, "Troops home now from Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Iraq." This looks like a very long list of sponsors. I won't read them all. But why don't you tell us about what's going on here? I know that groups like CUTSA, which is the Connecticut Students Against War, and United for Justice with Peace are on here, Stop the Wars Coalition, New England United, American Friends Service Committee. Why don't you tell us what's happening in Boston on the 17th?
I really encourage people to come out for October 17th. It's going to be a great event. Part of the problem with the anti-war movement in the last few years, if your listeners don't know, you know, it was very fragmented and divided. But I'm looking at the list of endorsers for the October 17th march, and you have on there United for Peace and Justice, you have ANSWER, and you have all these other fantastic groups who are coming together to march on the streets to demand several things, but the main issue is all troops home now from Afghanistan, Iraq, and also, you know, no attacks on Pakistan. And I think that is what's going to be a very strong force, and it will, you know, when we have a united action, when all these groups are bringing their people and their milieus, you know, closer to the movement, you know, we have a greater ability of mobilizing and reaching the levels of, you know, that we had before the war even started. In New York City on February 15th, 2003, we had 500,000 people in the streets, and, you know, we had a you know, formidable force behind us. And so we need to build back up to that level. And I think that's how we're going to make serious change.
What about the significance of the soldiers in Darjamel's book that have found the will to resist war?
His new book, which I have not yet read, but just reading the title from it, about soldier resistance, is huge for students right now, and very important point to make. As troops, as the soldiers are, you know, one way that this war, that these wars and occupations can come to an end, by their refusal to fight, as they did in during the Vietnam era, we see now a certain level of troop resistance, whether it's Travis Bishop or it's Victor Augusto, has given us a lot of encouragement and support. And along with that, you know, the troops and soldiers are going to have a easier time of resisting and refusing to fight if we're out in the streets building the mass movement. And, you know, one way that, you know, people can participate in that is the upcoming marches for October 17th. There's going to be 30 cities around the country, but regionally, we're going to be going up to Boston on that day. And there's a planning meeting for anybody interested in building this in Middletown, Connecticut, at the Church of the Holy Trinity. Connecticut United for Peace will be organizing it. It's 381 Main Street, 2 to 4 p.m.
And that planning meeting, Sunday, October 4th, 2 to 4 p.m. at the Church of the Holy Trinity, which is, again, Main Street, 381 Main Street, Middletown, Connecticut. Miriam Curlin joins us next to talk about an event September 19th with Dar Jamail. It starts at 6 p.m. with a potluck and then a film. The bases are loaded with Dar Jamail and Chalmers Johnson in that film. And then Dar Jamail will be on hand to speak with the group at the Wrench in the Works Collective. That's at 861 Main Street in Willimantic. There will be a workshop on a proposed bill to prevent the U.S. military from stripping soldiers of earned benefits for refusing to deploy to war. And Miriam Curlin is going to be talking about why that event was important for her to organize.
Everybody who's going to be there is going to be concerned about the military and the soldiers that are being deployed and redeployed and redeployed. I just can't imagine the horror. I just can't imagine somebody surviving that kind of the stresses that the soldiers are having to go through there. After hearing one of your interviews with Dar Jamail, the way they're coping, a lot of the soldiers are now coping with it is by pretending they're doing the jobs that they're supposed to be doing because they know that if they go ahead and do it, they have a really good chance of dying or killing somebody. So they're trying to figure out ways to make it look like they're doing it and not doing it. And I applaud them for doing that and really using their own heads and thinking for themselves. And I admire them for standing up to a war that's not about saving America and saving Americans, but about getting oil and helping the people who are benefiting and profiting from war to keep profiting. And I think, you know, that everybody there will be interested in figuring out good solutions. There's so many bright, caring, passionate activists in our area. I'm very positive that we'll be able to come up with some kind of strategies and to lead us in the right direction.
Miriam Curlin lives in Mansfield, Connecticut. We've been speaking about Dar Jamail's 2009 book, The Will to Resist, Soldiers Who Refuse to Fight in Iraq and Afghanistan. And during our recent interview with Dar, he spoke about the tricks U.S. soldiers have admitted to using so that they can avoid going out on patrol in Iraq. And we spoke with Vietnam veteran Fred Lewis, who said this happened during the Vietnam War, too. Let's listen first to what Dar Jamail said.
You know, I talk with people who are very frank with me. For example, Seth Manziel, who I talk about in the book, who's now up in Washington State, and he's since helped found a GI resistance coffee house called Coffee Strong. He said, look, when I was over there, I was a vehicle commander, and we drove like crazy. We ran cars off the road. We shot in the air. We terrorized people because we were so afraid that we decided we were just going to do whatever we had to do to survive and get back in one piece. And then that, fortunately for a lot of soldiers, translated into doing other things, like, you know what, instead of actually even going out on these patrols, let's figure out a way not to do that, because when we go out on patrols, all we do is jeopardize our lives and, of course, the lives of Iraqis. And so Seth, of course, went on to tell me that he, along with several other soldiers, had learned how to manipulate the location of his patrol on a computer screen so that rather than having to drive around on patrol, they could sit there and drink tea with Iraqis someplace and have a guy out in their Humvee moving their little blip around on the screen so the headquarters would think they were actually moving around and on patrol. And I interviewed several different people that told me the same story. And then again, the military is not really doing enough to bring people back home and reintegrate them and debrief them properly, and then certainly not doing enough to deal with their post-traumatic stress disorder. So, and then, of course, that sets the stage for a different kind of resistance once they get back home.
Joining us now, Fred Lewis, Connecticut Vet for Peace. Mr. Lewis, thank you for joining us.
You're quite welcome.
Dar Jamail told us about GIs in Iraq and Afghanistan who are doing a wide variety of things to avoid another patrol. And sometimes these are soldiers who have said they've done things that they already don't think they can live with. They don't want to kill anybody else. At other times, these are soldiers who can't take the war anymore, but they can't get home. Can you talk about that context for war as it relates to your personal story and what you know about war and the United States of America?
There were maybe a few sort of gung-ho people in my unit, but for the most part, all of us had one mission, and one mission only was to get home in one piece. We are often, as often as we could, faked patrols, which was certainly a lot easier since there was no GPS back then. You know, we'd be sent a spot on the map to go set up an ambush and just not go there. Go someplace that we considered a lot safer. Once or twice it got us into big trouble, almost got us killed. But for the most part, it worked quite well. I remember one night we actually went into this local village instead of going out where we were supposed to be, found this photography shop, and all had our portraits taken. it was a nice experience.
It sounds like a very human experience rather than an experience of a war zone.
Exactly, exactly, and that was rare.
Do you think that resistance, you know, to going on patrol, partly was to reclaim your humanity in this war zone?
I think it was mostly just to keep us alive as much as possible, to stay out of the fighting. I mean, that's the ultimate reclaiming of humanity, I guess. I think in the context of what's going on now in terms of GI resistance, I think the history of Vietnam, which is largely untold, is very telling, because I think to a large extent that war ended because of GI resistance, because there was a total breakdown of discipline within the service members over there, people refusing to go on patrol, people, you know, fragging officers.
Just say what fragging means, because a lot of people don't know what fragging was in those days. It was killing.
Well, there was a wonderful quote from Joseph Heller's Catch-22, which is, the enemy is anyone who's trying to get you killed. And GIs were rolling grenades under officers' bunks in order to get rid of officers who they felt were endangering their lives. And it became known as fragging, but there were certainly instances of officers being shot by their own men and stuff.
There were instances, too, of just missions that went awry or didn't go the way they were supposed to go?
Oh, for sure. All the time. So I think this stuff is very important, and I think supporting these guys is incredibly important, and they're unbelievably brave to be doing what they're doing. You know, my great regret was, my great shame over that period of my life was never saying no. You know, just going along with the whole thing and never saying, I'm not doing this anymore, it's crazy. So for those that are doing that, and I understand, I mean, I can't imagine going back for 2 and 3 and 4 tours over there that they're doing with these people, and it's a nightmare. It's a total nightmare.
When you were in the service, did you have a family at home? Or?
Sure. I mean, I wasn't married and had kids or anything, but, you know, I had my parents and my sisters and friends and all that.
Did you start a family of your own when you came home?
I didn't start a family until 1983. So, no, not certainly right away. I was pretty numb.
Yeah. A lot of veterans in the Vietnam War era have said they either waited to start a family or didn't get to do it at all. And I always thought of that as another casualty of that war.
Oh, sure. Collateral damage was everywhere, including even those that started families, you know, abusing their spouses or abusing their kids. Or it just, the ripples just go on and on and on.
Was it more difficult for you coming home that the Vietnam War had become so unpopular, such a negative, both within the military and, you know, for the American people?
For me, coming back in February of 69, here I was. My family didn't know exactly when I was coming for circumstances that are not important. So it was a total surprise that I was getting home when I got home. So I flew, you know, from Seattle to New York, and I literally had to bribe, I was in full dress uniform, I had to bribe the cab driver to take me to the middle of Brooklyn to my parents' house, because he was a cab driver trying to make money, and he wanted to go back to mid-Manhattan where he could get a fare, not to the middle of Brooklyn at 11 o'clock at night. And so he just refused to take me home. And I finally said, well, I'll give you $10 over the meter. And he said, okay. And he drove like a maniac and got me home. But that was the atmosphere.
That sounds so sad for you.
So that was one of my welcome homes.
And did you have any consequences from the war that were, you know, health related or physical? Or how did you come out of the war just in terms of the residual impact on you personally?
I have gone through 40 years of denial, of saying, oh, you know, I've been okay. You know, I've held jobs. I raised a family. My two sons are absolutely unbelievable gems. And, you know, I wasn't very affected by a year in combat. And this past few months, it's just hit me big time. And I've recently gone to the VA, and I'm currently in the process of filing for disability.
Do you mean to say that you feel now that you're realizing the impact on you that you didn't realize before?
I'm saying I'm realizing that because it's become unavoidable. I've been feeling just so mentally and really physically horrible, at least initially, not even knowing why. And then more and more coming to the place where, you know, I raise my hand and I say, hi, I'm Fred, I have PTSD. And I'm not alone in that experience. There's still Vietnam veterans dying as a direct result of that war, either by drinking themselves to death or any number of other things. And there's still, I would imagine, tens of thousands of us, at least, out there who haven't dealt with their war experience.
We're speaking with Fred Lewis, a veteran of the Vietnam War. Fred, we want to wish you the best on that and hope you get through.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I use all the help I can get.
Fred Lewis, we're going to be putting more of these interviews up on the internet so people can hear more of what you've had to say and of what other guests on the show today have had to say as well. But do you think that the Vietnam War and the current war are kind of merging now in your consciousness and just in terms of your responses to news and so on?
I mean, I knew Vietnam was wrong, and I've certainly now come to, there's no such thing as a good war. There's absolutely no such thing as a good war. And there's always an alternative and a better way to deal with things.
Are there any organizations that you'd like to commend or talk about here, finally?
Commend. Iraq Veterans Against the War need all the support they can get. They're absolutely wonderful people. And there are other organizations supporting resistors, guys that are in Canada, beyond. People are speaking truth to power.
Fred Lewis, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Oh, you're quite welcome.
Fred Lewis, Veterans for Peace. The website is veteransforpeace.org, and he lives in Connecticut. If you're in need of information about GI rights, there is the GI Rights Hotline, 877-447-4487. And if you'd like to look up Dar Jamail, his website is dahr.org. To learn more about Dar Jamail's Connecticut tour, go to willtoresistwar.blogspot.com. It features information about six events, starting at the Wrench in the Works, Willimantic, September 19th at 6 p.m. At Hope Out Loud, Peace and Arts Festival, Hartford, September 20th, Dar will speak at 2:30 on that day. Also, Dar Jamail speaks at UConn, the University of Connecticut Dodd Center in Storrs, on September 20th at 7:30 p.m. And on Monday, the UN International Day of Peace, September 21st, Dar Jamail will be at three universities, ECSU, Eastern Connecticut State University in Willimantic, 1 p.m., CCSU, Central Connecticut State University, New Britain, 6 p.m., and Wesleyan University, Memorial Chapel, Middletown, Connecticut, in a program beginning at 7:30 p.m., and also featuring singer-songwriter David Rovix, davidrovix.com. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. This program is produced in Storrs, Connecticut. TalkNationRadio.org. For transcripts, audio, and discussions, write to me at TalkNationRadio@gmail.com.